you.
This is Sound Effect. I'm Jennifer Wing, and I am in Marsha Morse's office. There are windows on all sides, and the view is incredible. Water, sailboats, and Vashon Island. It is quickly approaching.
Thank you, Charlie.
We are on board the Issaquah Ferry, and Marsha, she's the captain. She was one of the first women hired by Washington State Ferries 42 years ago, and she kind of stumbled into this job.
I was actually riding the ferry, and I was talking to a deckhand. We were feeding seagulls, and I was just chatting, saying I was looking for work. I was out of college, and he said, oh, you should get on with the ferries. They hire women now.
What year was this?
That was 1975.
What has it been like for you to be a pioneer in this industry?
My quest has always been, I just want to do the job and be allowed to do the job. And that wasn't always the case for anyone. When you first came on a boat, they oftentimes didn't train anyone.
What do you mean they wouldn't train anyone?
They basically told you just little basics, you know, like grab a block, do this, you know, whatever. Block that car, swab that deck, and they might not really tell you how or even be friendly, you know. When I had someone show me what to do or tell me, I really valued them as a friend and an ally.
How do you get around when there's really thick fog? How do you guys figure that out?
That's what radars are for. Before radars, which was right before I came here, so some of the old-time captains used whistle echoes, time and distance, and wait and count how long it would take for the echo to come back off the bluff.
They'd use echolocation.
Whistle echo off the bluffs, yeah.
What are some of the stories you've gathered over the years dealing with passengers as you've done this work?
Well, you get everybody coming through the ferries in their everyday state, which could be good, could be bad. We've had deaths.
On the boat, you've had people die.
Oh, people die on the boat. People have babies on the boats. We have the whole cross-section of life coming across on the ferries.
Today, we are hopping on ferries and traveling to the islands of the Northwest. We are on island time here on Sound Effect. We'll tell you how one couple came to own a little piece of paradise in the San Juans. We'll explore the challenges of dating when you live on an island. And yes, these places are gorgeous, but they can be really expensive. We'll learn what some people are doing to make island life a little bit more affordable. It's all ahead here on Sound Effect. Islands. Some are big, some are small. What is it about these places that call to us and make us take planes and boats to get there? I have a theory. I think that for some of us, having that barrier of water, it gives us the feeling or the illusion that whatever problems we have, they'll somehow stay behind. One place where people have been escaping to for a long time is the San Juans. The San Juans are home to over 400 islands. All of the available islands in the San Juans were snatched up by homesteaders by 1919, all but one, a lonely, rocky 15-acre dot close to San Juan Island. This mound of earth became the object of one young couple's obsession. It drew them across the country. Sound Effect contributor Hannah Byrne shares the adventure of her great-grandparents.
Oh, by the way, before you start, I just happened to think, what are you thankful for today?
Well, I don't know. I'm just a little bit timid to say over the radio.
That's June and Farrar Byrne, my great-grandparents.
I'm thankful that 30 years ago I ran across the right woman. Well, here we are.
Farrar loved to sing, and when he ran out of money, he often played songs for cash.
With a plunky plunk plunk, I will sing you my junk. Perhaps it won't sound very well.
June and Farrar fell in love fast. It was spring 1919. June, charmed by Farrar's ruddy-cheeked smile and curly red hair. Farrar, drawn to June's lively eyes and fierce spirit. I asked my dad, Mark, how they went from Maryland to the West Coast. It all started, he told me, when June and Farrar rolled out a map to see where they might go.
And there was this island
which to people that lived here didn't have any value because there were no beaches and no water and no soil to grow things, so nobody wanted it.
That island was the last homesteadable piece of the San Juans. It was tiny, unwanted, a lonely 15-acre dot. And June and Farrar, they definitely wanted it. June wrote,
"To go on an island and pull the ladder up after us and live, untroubled by anything, that would be heaven."
Back then, the U.S. Homestead Act allowed citizens to apply to own land. If accepted, they'd get the land for little or sometimes zero cost. It's how much of the San Juans came under ownership. June and Farrar applied for land at the end of the homesteading flurry. When the General Land Office in Seattle replied back, "The news was bad. You're too late," they said. "You missed the boat." But instead of giving up on that island dream, June and Farrar wrote back, "Keep our application, we're coming anyways." And they took off for the Northwest. The whole journey took a couple of months.
"I love the green valley of the Cascade Range, out where the swift river flows, where wild eagles cry from the black crags high, on mountain peaks covered with snow."
Along the way, June sent letters to the land office every week. She wrote gossip from the journey, treated them like old friends. Farrar called it her direct mail campaign for an island. When they got to Seattle, June and Farrar walked into the land office. "Our name is Byrne," Farrar started, and the office erupted. They're here," people shouted. And to June and Farrar's delight, the direct mail campaign had worked. The 15-acre dot was theirs.
"Out where the swift rivers flow, out where the swift rivers flow."
The dot, it turned out, had a name, Sentinel. On a map, it looks like a tiny speck in Spuyten Channel. In a matter of months, June was sitting at the back of a rowboat, watching their tall, green lump in the ocean get closer and closer. Then, finally, they hit rocky land. June and Farrar had made it. Sentinel lived up to its reputation. Mostly trees, some grass, and a smattering of soil pockets to grow food. June promptly nicknamed it
Gumdrop Island.
And despite its shortcomings, my dad told me June and Farrar had a way of making a rocky dot in the Salish Sea feel like something special.
They would just build a little shake shelter and gather flat sandstones and make a floor out of that. Farrar might bake bread on the fire in some kind of a Dutch oven, and he just had a knack for creating this wonderful feeling.
After they homesteaded Sentinel, June and Farrar never kept still for long. For the next couple decades, they hopped from one thing to the next. They had kids. They moved to a remote island near Siberia. They traveled the U.S. in a renovated old Dodge. At one point, June hitchhiked across the country with her young son. June used to say,
"I wonder why everybody doesn't do their retiring first while they have the zest for everything and settle down later on when they don't feel like doing anything but work anyhow."
Sometimes I wonder, did the adventure gene skip me? Why aren't I living in a camper, exploring the world? But then I think about something else my dad told me about his grandmother. June was strong-willed, wicked clever, and full of a kind of fierce energy that never seemed to quit.
Life was intense for her.
Intense in what way?
Well, I think her husband, Farrar, would describe her as close to the edge of sanity, could be even, but...
And that's how my great-grandparents lived out the rest of their lives, pursuing adventure and simple pleasures with relentless intensity. Eventually, June wrote a book about their experiences. It's called Living High. And Farrar, well, he kept on singing.
"I can't forget that summer day when from my home I went away."
As far as Gumdrop Island goes, June and Farrar left after about 5 years. Today, it belongs to the Nature Conservancy, returned to its natural state, a lonely little dot poking out from the sea.
"The grass waving in the breeze. I said goodbye to Pa and Ma and left my home in Arkansas."
That story from sound effect contributor Hannah Byrne.
Everywhere, a working here, a working there.
You're tuned to Sound Effect. I'm Jennifer Wing. Our theme today is Island Time. Affordable housing and not enough of it is a headline we read and hear on a regular basis in the Seattle area. This challenge also exists in the San Juan Islands, where people tend to either be incredibly wealthy or they're in line at the local food bank. On the mainland, if you have a job that doesn't pay a lot, at least you have the option to move further out if you have a car to a place with cheaper rent. But a long commute is not an option on an island. A nonprofit in Friday Harbor is bringing affordable housing to the island. This involves importing old houses that are no longer wanted in Victoria, British Columbia. It's pretty involved. Sound effect producer Kevin Kniestad went to Friday Harbor to see how it all works.
Is this door open to the deck?
It does.
Okay, you want to go outside?
Sure. All
right. Angela Atwell is days away from getting the keys to this house. From the deck, we see what is a soon-to-be landscaped backyard.
In our little yard, we envision, of course, some grass, maybe a little fenced-in area, and a fire pit with a couple of chairs around it, and just good times outside out back.
Angela is a single mom, has two teenage kids, and works as an administrator at Skagit Valley College. I asked her if she would still be living on the island had this house not come along.
I would have been in the mainland right now, quite honestly, if this hadn't come through, because when my landlord asked for his house back, I would have been forced, had I not been able to find the housing, which I couldn't find last summer, I couldn't find replacement rental housing, even temporarily, to get me to this point. So, yes, I would have had to leave a great job that I had for over 10 years and uprooted my children who've been here since they were in preschool. So,
Angela's story is one that is all too familiar for many people on the island.
There is a saying about being in the islands, you either have three jobs or three homes.
That's Sarah Crosby. She's the chair of the board of directors of the San Juan Community Home Trust.
Property values have skyrocketed over time, and yet we are a thriving working community, but the salaries don't increase in the way that property values do. And people who've lived here all their lives are leaving because they can't afford to buy a home or get a job that will sustain them and their families. And we don't want that. We want a diverse community.
And the Home Trust has come up with an interesting way of helping. In Victoria, where many old classic houses are being torn down to make way for new development, the Home Trust is purchasing these homes and moving them to Friday Harbor. Pete Kilpatrick is the owner of Ravenhill Construction on the island, which fixes up these homes when they arrive. He's been on the Home Trust board for about 15 years.
One of our board members lives in a house that had been moved from Victoria, and it became evident that there was real opportunity right now with just the number of houses being torn down in Victoria. The old, poor old houses are just not wanted anymore, so we're definitely taking care and taking advantage of that opportunity.
The cost of buying, moving, and renovating these early to mid-20th century homes adds up to about $180,000 each, and if the Home Trust was to build brand new houses instead for that price, they'd be much smaller and very much cookie cutter. And each one of these homes that gets moved here is named after the street they were saved from. From the road that leads into the cul-de-sac that these houses sit, Sarah Crosby introduces them to me.
So we're looking straight ahead at Hampshire. And Hampshire and the houses which flank it on either side were the three original homes we bought. Cavendish on the left and Victoria on the right. And then we took possession of Holly and View Royal.
And the name of the house that Angela Atwell will be moving into is named Hamiota. We headed inside Hamiota to see how things look.
Oh, we have light fixtures and light.
Pete is showing Angela some of the more recent improvements that have been made, and Nancy DeVoe, the executive director of the San Juan Community Home Trust, shows me around.
We're protecting the floors right now with paper, but the beautiful wood flooring in all of these homes is one of the features we really like. This house was in great shape. We didn't have to do all the kitchen remodeling that we did in the other houses. The counters and the cabinets are really nice.
Upstairs, Angela is sharing her plans for the bedrooms.
This is actually my son's bedroom. This one here is mine. It's the smallest, and because of the dormers, my son is 17. So he had a little bit of a phobia about being in a shorter ceilinged room, and I'm only 5 foot. So I didn't mind taking this room at all.
In each room that we walk into, Angela lights up when she talks about the house's character.
They have some older windows. Sometimes when you look at them, you'll get that wavy look. And the one I'm looking at particularly now has kind of a frosted pattern on it, so it's really pretty, and you don't see that anymore. So if people can picture like actual Victorian homes and imagine what they're like, this house itself was built in 1908, so we're gonna have a 110-year-old birthday party for it next year, but just all of these unique features, and there's crown molding and everything that make it really, really nice.
Angela, like everyone else on the cul-de-sac that has been given the opportunity to purchase one of these homes, has to put in 50 hours of sweat equity. As we head back outside, Sarah Crosby says that in addition to making the homes and area look nicer, there is a sense of community that develops.
They've been over helping to clean up the construction site as well as work on their own homes. And in the doing of that, they've created a community already. And if you were to be here with all the homeowners here, you would see that there are relationships that have been formed.
And the community that is being created here, from Angela to the bartender and DJ that lives next door, to the married couple that work at the local grocery store together, to the massage therapist across the street, this is all one little sliver of diversity that the members of the San Juan Community Home Trust dream of seeing island-wide.
The magic about living in the San Juan Islands is that you've got people from all walks of life living, working, and playing together. And I think we're much richer because of that. So affordable housing hits me on a very visceral level.
This is just part of an expression of a love of this place, love of this community, living on an island.
I can relate very much to the home buyers in our program. I was a single mom on the island, and I moved 10 times, I think, while my son was growing up here. So I can really relate to the people who are struggling with that kind of pressure to constantly have to move. You're living in a rental house, the owners decide to sell it. It's a very frequent story that people can't stay where they are living for too long.
The San Juan Community Home Trust has over 40 names on a wait list that would like to get into one of these houses. But as it is so often the case, funding is one of the biggest roadblocks to expanding this enterprise. There's no shortage of land or Victorian houses available for purchase. And with each house that carefully gets picked off its foundation, makes its way onto a barge, and slowly gets put into place in Friday Harbor, someone like Angela can begin to look forward to moving to her very own place on the island she loves.
My kids got me a present. I have always loved African violets, and recently my African violets at home died, so they got me 2 new African violets for my windowsill. So those will go in the windowsill, and I'm going to have coffee on the deck, and I think we're just going to relax for a little bit in our pajamas before we begin unpacking.
That story was from Sound Effects' Kevin Kniestad. And by the way, Angela, she is now happily settled in her home. This is Sound Effect. I'm Jennifer Wing, and today our show is Island Time. And our next story is about a man trying to escape an island in South Puget Sound, McNeil Island. This is where the Special Commitment Center for Sexually Violent Predators is located. It's been housing this population since 1990. And this story, it deals with some difficult material, so if you don't wish to hear it, or if you have kids around, now would be a good time to take a break and rejoin the show in about 10 minutes. So there are about 250 permanent residents at the Special Commitment Center. That's what they're called, residents. And there are only a few ways you can leave. You can die. You can be deemed to have successfully completed treatment, or you can challenge your commitment with a trial. This is what a man called Chris did. He went for the trial. And we're not using his last name to protect the identity of his family members, who are also his victims. Chris's fight to get off the island and back into regular society was chronicled by the podcast Here Be Monsters, which is based in Seattle.
Jeff Emptman is the producer and host, and Bethany Denton is the managing editor. We talked with Jeff and Bethany about Chris's journey, and all of the audio in the interview you're about to hear comes from their original story. We start with Chris and how he ended up on McNeil.
Chris is someone who's been in the system for a very long time. Beth, how old was he roughly when we talked to him?
He was in his mid to late 30s.
Mid to late 30s. And he had been involved with the system ever since he was 16, which is when he was initially caught with a neighborhood boy a couple of years younger than him in a form of sexual contact. He was convicted of that sexual crime. And in that trial, it came out that he had also committed hundreds of other sexual offenses against mostly his family members. He wound up serving 2 years in juvie for this. And when he was released at 18, he went to a hospital here in Seattle for a psych evaluation, at which time he reported some very deviant fantasies to some staff there. And at that time, he was given the status as a sexually violent predator, an SVP. And at that point, he became a resident of McNeil Island at the Special Commitment Center for 18 years.
Why does Chris say that he was having these deviant thoughts?
Chris had a lot of mental problems growing up. Some of the conditions that he'd been diagnosed with were ADD, ADHD, bipolar disorder, Tourette syndrome, and that's just some of the list. And so for these conditions, he was given kind of a lot of different medications over the course of his childhood and early adulthood, including lithium, Luvox, clonidine, anafrenil. And so as Chris told it to us, he said that living on these medications as a teenager made him feel perpetually drunk.
Probably the biggest factor in me changing was my getting off of those drugs. It allowed me to get a lot of really, really weird, crazy, and scary thoughts and fantasies out of my head.
And he said that essentially, you know, after these fantasies abated, he was stuck on an island where people were telling him that he was something he wasn't. And that's why he wanted to have a trial, though it took 18 years to get there.
18 years.
Yeah.
At the time of the release of this episode a year ago, there had been just over 50 residents that had been released from the SEC in its entire history. So the release rate of these residents is relatively low.
And again, this special commitment center on McNeil Island, it's been operating since 1990. And Chris knew that his chances of getting off the island were unlikely. And one way to get released is to ask for a trial that challenges his civil commitment. And this is what he did. And the burden wasn't on Chris to prove that he was free of sexually violent thoughts. The burden in cases like this, it falls on the state.
The state must prove beyond a reasonable doubt that if Chris were to be released, unconditionally released from the SEC, that he would be more likely than not to reoffend. So it was the state that had to lay out a convincing case against Chris, and Chris and his attorneys, their job was really just to prove that the state could not establish beyond a reasonable doubt that he would more likely than not reoffend. There was a jury selection. There were expert witnesses shipped in.
And some of these special witnesses were doctors.
Yes.
Correct? And what did they say when they were asked if Chris was likely to reoffend?
You know, the doctors that were called by the people saying that Chris was an SVP said that Chris would be likely to reoffend.
Doctor, you said you reached an opinion. What is that opinion?
That he is more likely than not to commit acts of sexual violence as a result of his mental abnormality, if not confined to a secure facility.
And the doctors that were called by the people saying that he wouldn't be an SVP said that he probably wouldn't reoffend.
Is he still that same confused, angry kid that he was back then, now, in 2016? And my answer is, no, he isn't. And he hasn't been for quite some time.
And this was the testimony. This was kind of the expert testimony that took place over the course of several days.
Did Chris eventually take the stand?
He did.
Fantasies like that are
almost anathema to me these days. It's so completely repulsive that I wouldn't even be able to conceive of it these days. However, I can understand, you know, people being scared or concerned because, you know, it is something that was, you know, so outrageous that, you know, I was having back in the day.
Since the stakes were so high for on the part of the state, beyond a reasonable doubt, what did the prosecution say about Chris? What they must have just gone all out.
They certainly did.
First time, Mr. was 9 years old, 6 years older than his three-year-old sister. The first time that he took her out to the shed in the backyard, where no one could know what was happening, no one could see what was happening, and no one could hear what was happening. But to be sure, he barricaded the shed door.
Again, what did the jury have to decide, and again explain what was at stake?
The jury had to decide whether the state had made a convincing argument that Chris was still an SVP.
They only deliberated for a day.
Madam Clerk, please read the verdict in the record.
We, the jury, answer the question submitted by the court as follows. Has the state proved beyond a reasonable doubt that Christopher is to be a sexually violent predator? Answer, no. Signed by the presiding juror of this case.
And what happened after the verdict was handed down and it was announced that the jury decided in his favor? What happened?
He actually got an nearly immediate unconditional release. So within 48 hours, he was leaving the island.
You talked to the prosecutor after the decision was handed down. What did she have to say?
She was very concerned that Chris had dropped out of treatment.
That he dropped out of treatment when he was on McNeil Island.
That was one of the main points that they used to strengthen their argument that Chris should still be considered an SVP.
And again, to remind our listeners, an SVP is a sexually violent predator.
One kind of striking quote from the interview that we did with her was her talking about how she really hopes never to see him again. Because if she sees him again, that means that something went wrong. You know, this idea that being out, being in society, he'll be faced with his old triggers. She painted it in a way where it sounded like kind of something at the top of a hill that just needs a nudge.
What made the two of you want to sit with such a heavy topic?
It's endlessly complicated. How does a jury decide whether or not a state knows what the future of a person holds? How does science try to understand the future of a person? I think anytime you see a group labeled as angelic or demonic, that's a place to start looking for nuance, because it's always there. I think it's always there. I think Chris is an intensely nuanced person, but it is just incredibly easy to say, you're a sex offender, go live on that island.
What about the whole concept of the special commitment center? Do you think that facilities like that are necessary in our society?
I think that it kind of comes down to what scares you more, the idea that someone like Chris lives among us, or the idea that we live in a society that warehouses and locks away people like Chris.
Forever.
Forever, potentially. And I don't know the answer to that.
Jeff Emptman and Bethany Denton, thank you so much for joining us here on Sound Effect.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
If you haven't checked out the Here Be Monsters podcast, then you must, because it's wonderful. Go to our website, knkx.org, where you will find a link. You're listening to Sound Effect on 88.5 KNKX. I'm Jennifer Wing. All of the stories for this show have some connection to an island. If you go to the bottom of Vashon Island, there's a spit of land that's sort of in the shape of a bent arm. It used to be separate from Vashon. It used to be its own island, Maury Island. Along the shores of Maury Island, on June 21st, 1947, something incredibly violent happened to a man named Harold Dahl, his son Charles, their dog, and two dock workers. They were out on Dahl's boat, searching for stray logs to resell to the local sawmills, when six round objects appeared in the sky.
At first, you know, they were just hovering. One was lower than the others, much lower than the others.
This is Steve Edmiston. He and his filmmaking partner, Scott Schaefer, made a movie about this day and the events that followed called The Maury Island Incident. And again, these are flying saucers in the sky that allegedly appeared on June 21st, 1947 at 2 in the afternoon.
And that lower flying disc eventually started dropping what they described as chaff. Kind of, if you've seen paper burn in a fireplace, I don't think they ever described it as dangerous, but the next thing that happened was
this flying saucer that this ash was dropping from, it had an explosion, and molten metal started falling from the sky.
When this fiery slag, and that seems to be the word that gets used historically, was coming down, the son, Charles, his arm was severely burned, according to their allegations. The dog was killed by the slag falling from the sky. So they're so frightened that they take this 50-foot boat and they run it up on the beach so that they can get off the boat and hide in the cliffs that are on the beach there on Maury Island. And then these objects leave. They get the boat back in the water, they get on the boat, and as they go back to Tacoma, they kind of decide that they won't talk about this. They don't know what to say about what they've seen. What happens next is maybe the even more extraordinary part of the story. On June 22nd, the next day.
The very next day,
at Harold Dahl's house, a man shows up, knocks on the door at 6:30 in the morning, and he is dressed in black. You know, he's that black suit, the jacket and the pants and the white shirt and the black tie and the black shoes and everything that we would now in our modern world associate with the Men in Black. This man's at the door, and he wants to talk to Harold Dahl about what Harold saw yesterday, the day before, on the water. He doesn't want to talk about it there. He wants to go to a diner and talk about it. And at the diner, the man proceeds to point by point recount what Harold saw the day before on the water and concludes that recitation with a warning that Harold probably shouldn't be talking about what he saw.
Did this man in black, did he ever identify himself as being from a government agency?
I didn't come across any account, you know, as we went through lots of documentation that was generated, you know, in the investigations that followed, that he made a specific identification of who he was with.
How does the meeting end?
If there was, in fact, a meeting and a warning that you shouldn't talk about it, Harold didn't follow that advice. You know, Harold did talk to friends and family. The word of what he saw did get out. And then, according to Harold Dahl, many, many bad things happened, just like the man in black said they would. Bad things will happen if you talk. Bad things did allegedly happen to Harold Dahl.
What happened?
Well, there's a whole bunch of things, and Scott can help me fill in.
I'm Scott Schaefer. I'm a filmmaker and a journalist. You know, bad things did happen to Harold Dahl. His wife attacked him with a knife at one time.
That story has been corroborated, and we think that it was had become so upsetting that Harold Dahl was telling a story that was subjecting the family to ridicule. We speculate that his wife became so upset, she literally attacked him. His boat was damaged and vandalized. His business was vandalized. His son, Charles, literally disappeared, like he was gone. Like, did he run away? Was he abducted? They didn't know. 2 weeks later, he was found in Lusk, Montana.
The son was found in Lusk, Montana.
In Lusk, Montana.
At a restaurant, I believe.
At a restaurant with no recall of how or why he was there.
And again, to remind our listeners, this is the summer of 1947, and the sighting was one of hundreds, if not thousands, of reported UFO sightings. This was the summer when people reported seeing a UFO crash near Roswell, New Mexico. Did the U.S. government take all of these claims seriously?
Yes. What happened was, in the summer of 1947, you have to think about what was going on in the country, in the world at that time. We were just a few years out of World War II, and we had already been told or discovered that we had a brand new enemy, the Soviet Union. So what was happening was the dawn of the Cold War was upon us. So in the summer of 1947, when people like Harold Dahl started saying they saw objects in the sky, all branches of our government, FBI, the Army, the newly formed CIA, were all actively investigating sightings. And the reason isn't because the government thought little green men were here. It's because, well, what if the Soviet Union is overflying our country?
Yeah, maybe they have new kind of airplanes.
They were really concerned about that. And that's why they were chasing these leads down.
Not too long after Harold Dahl's sighting, two officers from the U.S. Air Force take the lead on investigating what happened to Harold. They interview him. They take some of the slag, the metal stuff that fell from the sky, and label it top secret. Then the men get on a plane headed to California. The plane catches on fire and crashes in the forest east of Kelso, Washington, and both investigators die. Someone from the government swoops into the crash site to collect the top secret evidence, and it's at this point the FBI takes over the investigation.
And the lead agent at the FBI was a man named Jack Wilcox.
Okay.
And so we have all of his memos that were being generated daily, you know, documenting the results of the investigation, that went directly to J. Edgar Hoover, who, as it turns out, had some weird habits. One of them was also a fascination with this kind of stuff.
With UFOs.
Yes.
Yes. So does Harold Dahl, does he have to go through a whole new interrogation? I'm guessing these FBI agents want to talk to him.
Absolutely. They even get a confession from Harold Dahl that is characterized as a confession that it's a hoax, that they made it all up. So when you read the documents early in the investigation, the August 5th, 6th, 7th, 8th, 9th, that sort of early first few days, there's a lot of assumption in these documents that we think this is a hoax, that they've made it up, and we're going to close this case by proving that it's a hoax. And Harold Dahl is playing into that. He's telling everybody he can talk to, even the media, I made it all up. I'm the biggest, this is a quote, I am the biggest liar that ever lived. When they actually talk to Dahl, Dahl is crystal clear. I saw what I saw, and I'm not recanting that.
What about the confession?
Yes, but I am forever going to tell the world that I made it up.
Why?
Because the bad things that had happened to him were so bad, he would rather be accused of being a hoaxer than be accused of a crazy person that actually saw something.
What do you want someone who's stumbling onto this for the first time, what do you want them to get out of this tale?
If this is true, if this deep dive reveals a truth about this event, and all I had to do was, you know, figure out where the documents were and read them, and there's a truth that is completely divergent from, what's the phrase I'm looking for?
The public face of the story. Back in 1947.
That excites me, as if I'm a historian or just a storyteller, because it just sort of empowers me to say, wow, you know, I don't need to trust the public face of a story that is historical, that is interesting to me. I may want to go deeper, and it's that's like treasure hunting to me.
Well, Scott Schaefer, Steve Edmiston, it has been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to Sound Effect here on 88.5 KNKX. I'm Jennifer Wing, and our theme today is Island Time. I know that I have had this fantasy, ditching the concrete of the city life for an island full of farms, quiet beaches, and quaint bakeries. Yes, as we've heard earlier in the show, there are obstacles. It can be crazy expensive. But there's something else to consider. The tight-knit communities that exist on these islands are great. But what does this mean if you're single and you want a date? Sound Effect contributor Sarah Ann Lloyd traveled to Orcas Island to find out how living with watery boundaries can affect someone's search for romance.
Like many a Northwest city dweller, I've had my own fantasies about living on one of our local islands. And it's an idea that could seem loverly, given how often islands are the subject of Harlequin novels. But for people with purely romantic associations with islands, folks on islands are, for the most part, like people anywhere else, but under extremely tiny circumstances. When I went to Orcas Island to check out the dating scene, there wasn't much hand-holding going on.
Dating here is like going to high school. It really is, right? It's like going to high school with no parents, right?
This is Darul Shamsuddin. We met at the Lower Tavern Bar in East Sound. If you're single and on an island, this is how things often play out.
So when you want to date someone, you don't actually ask them out and go like, hey, let's go have dinner together. You like randomly run into them and be like, hey, what are you doing? I'm doing nothing. You want to go get naked? It's kind of how it works here.
Getting right to the point? It's a thing here on Orcas. Some people here do try to expand their reach with the usual dating apps, but these digital doors to other people don't take them very far. One islander at the Lower, Lily Ryder, has lived on the island since her early teens. And if you've been there that long, those apps don't show you anything new. Or they show you Canada.
Let's do some swiping. Actually, my friend's dad. Weird. Literally the last person who just talked to you. So this happens on Tinder a lot. It will be like, there are no people around you. You have swiped through Orcas Island tonight. Congratulations.
Even for those who might not know the whole island yet, like India Miller, who worked here only seasonally before moving here full-time recently, Tinder doesn't yield much romantic tandem bike riding.
Tinder, I found, is the one that most people are responding to. You're on Orcas. Let's have sex tonight. I'm like, okay, what? I haven't met you yet. I don't even know if you're a real person yet. So.
Vala Ross was born and raised here. Her word for dating on an island? Desolate.
If you can imagine a desert is surrounded by other land masses, an island is not. So it's sink or swim, you pretty much drown in a dating pool. You know, the loneliness comes and goes, obviously, mostly in seasons. Summer is good times for everybody.
Right now, single people on Orcas are headed into those good times. Summer. New prospects will be walking the sidewalks and going to work at the local summer camps. Mallory Hagel has lived here for 2 years and tells me how it all usually goes down.
You know, the farm interns start showing up in March, and if you work in a restaurant, like, you'll double the size of your staff and they'll all be new folks. And the people who are tourists who are here for short weekends. So there's a lot of casual things maybe happening. You know, someone that I know who's like awful and hilarious calls it sundress season. But yeah,
sundress season.
I know some people on the mainland that call it sundress season too. It turns out casual misogyny is everywhere. The rules are different with island dating. For example, normally it's considered gauche to date your friend's ex. But on an island, that's okay. There are only so many people after all. On the island, there's a saying. You never really break up with anyone.
you just lose your place in line. But if you do want to call it quits with a significant other, on an island, Mallory says a clean break is nearly impossible.
In Seattle, it was like I could like see someone for a little bit, it could go terribly, and then I could just like dodge their neighborhood. And here you cannot do that. You're accountable to what you did, and you're accountable to like that relationship can't just disappear into the mist. Yeah. I mean, some people figure out how to do it, but you gotta work really hard.
Whatever hookups, drama, 3-month romances happen on Orcas Island over the summer, the frenzy comes to a close in September, when populations and the tourism trade both dwindle, leaving little to do and fewer people for company.
There is an expression that I've heard called a winter blanket. And so often, I feel like around like November, people start kind of pairing up with sort of who they're going to be spending their winter with, essentially. You know, you got to stay warm. It's cold and lonely and dark and gray, and the boats run less often, and their restaurants are closed down, and you got to have something to do.
This is my biggest takeaway from my time in Orcas. People who grew up here or lived here during their formative years, they're used to living among the same people for, in some cases, entire lifetimes. It means they're steeped in a culture that lives life out in the open. You write your Tinder profile knowing that every single member of your community, all your friends and acquaintances, are going to see it. And that's okay. Which brings me back to what Mallory said about not being able to disappear. It brings with it a whole other level of accountability to your partners, to your community, and to yourself. Island life, and certainly island dating, is not without its quirks, its pain, and its drama. But it forces you to live your life and maintain your relationships in a way you're comfortable putting out in the open. Whatever that means to you.
That story from sound effect contributor Sarah Ann Lloyd. Sound Effect is produced by Kevin Kniestad and Posey Gruner. We got help this week from Janae Janik, Allie Ferguson, Kyle Norris, Hannah Byrne, Sarah Ann Lloyd, Jeff Emptman, Bethany Denton, Parker Miles Blom, Dave Nagaris, and Aaron Hennessy. Special thanks to KCRW in Santa Monica. Our executive producer is Floriangela Davila. Be sure to tune in next week. I'm Jennifer Wing, and this is KNKX.